Innovation Conversations from the Southwest Innovation Expo.
Hello and welcome to Innovation Conversations, a very special series of podcasts recorded here at the Southwest Innovation Expo at Sandy Park in Exeter, celebrating all things innovation and technology for the Southwest region of the UK. In this episode, we're taking a look at technology in agriculture, or agritech, as we give it its snappy title. I'd like to welcome our special guest, Jake Gibson-Shaw, Sutton Academic Lecturer in Robotics at the University of Plymouth, and also very pleased to say hello to the Earl of Devon, Charles Courtenay, who sits in the House of Lords and is also a barrister for Michelmore's LLP. Hello, good morning, gentlemen.
Top of the morning to
you. Top of the morning, or good afternoon, good evening, good night, depending on when you're listening to this. Agriculture and technology is not something we think about as consumers and the general public on a daily basis, but at the end of the day, it's something that's key to our daily lives, isn't it? With agriculture, you tend to get the impression that, I guess, farmers at this moment in time are finding things a little bit difficult, most certainly with regards to the economic climate and how things look like in the future. Is new technology helping them achieve more? What does that future look like? That's quite a big question, I can guess. Which one of you would like to take it first?
I can take that forwards. Agriculture has always depended upon technology. Obviously, as the population has grown over the last 40, 50, 60 years, we've always been horrified that we're not going to be able to feed the world, and somehow we managed to. And the way we do that is through the application of technology, and we've done it for hundreds of years in this country. Devon has a great tradition of breeding technology, a great tradition of improving productivity in how we grow things, and it's really the application of the same. What's been really interesting over the last 4 or 5 years, certainly post-Brexit, is we've taken agricultural policy back in hand from Europe, one of the Brexit dividends, and possibly the only one that we've really begun to deliver on. And with the legislation that's been passed, such as the Agriculture Act and the Environment Act, we're beginning to set standards for how we manage our landscape that's both environmentally positive and productive for food. And the only way we can do that, because, bless us, we're not making any more land in this country, we are an island and we're limited to what we can do, is through productivity gains, and that's through technology. And so the application of technology is absolutely crucial. And people, as you say, you know, note that farmers are struggling. It's been a really hard time. But as we've seen, farmers are really resilient. The fact that we've fed ourselves continually through the pandemic, through the complete breakdown in supply chains, etc., just shows that farming can and will adapt. But we need to be focused upon how they do that. And the science that you provide is probably the way to do that.
Let's take a look at the science then. What kind of scientific innovations are we talking about here?
If you look at a lot of different market areas or a lot of different industries, a lot of them have really been able to utilize new and modern technology, from the smarts on like mobile phones or satellite connectivity and all this new AI generation creation. The one area that's really not seen that same kind of adoption and feed-in has been in the agricultural side, which is a shame and massively disappointing, because it's an incredibly beneficial and incredibly powerful industry. Moving forward, there's now, because of all the changes afoot and the things coming about, there is this need for more efficiency to utilize space in a better manner. And that's something which the technology we already have that's currently applied in different areas can help massively from. Whether that's putting different plants in the same field and having selective harvesting or selective planting, or just utilizing and mapping out where best grows in what locations. In terms of what that's going to look like in the future, the near future is going to continue in a more traditional fashion with attachments for existing tractors and reutilizing current hardware. But moving further ahead, something that we've actually been doing quite a lot of trials and demonstrations with is using fully autonomous modular robots. Okay, there are some robot dogs in there as well, but normal modular tracked robots that can get around any kind of field, any steep incline, safely without a person being put in danger and being able to fully utilise that land.
So this is a really interesting point, because in order for all this innovation to happen, it has to be legislated and it has to receive its stamp of approval and moves through the powers that be. Charles, earlier on you mentioned about life post-Brexit and how the adaptation of control, or rather bringing control back to Westminster, is helping. In real terms, what does that mean? Does it mean that legislation, in order to facilitate the rollout of AI, won't take as long as it would do otherwise? How are we actually making this all happen? Because time's of the essence.
Yeah, time is very much of the essence. We've obviously got a 2050 net zero requirement legislated for only I think 6-7 years ago. What really happened when we left Europe from an agricultural perspective is we left the Common Agriculture Policy, which was a European-wide policy whereby money would be paid to farmers as a subsidy based upon the acreage that they farmed. And it was a fairly flat rate, blunt tool. It did support farming and enabled us to, you know, farmers, I'm a farmer too, so I should make that clear, but enabled farmers to survive. What the Agriculture Act has done is introduce this idea of environmental land management with the concept of public money being paid to farmers for the provision of a public good. And the public good are things like clean water, fresh air, preventing soil erosion, building organic matter in your soil, farming for biodiversity, using less sprays, less herbicides, insecticides, etc. But also providing better, healthier, more nutritious food. And so that legislation has been put in place. It's being rolled out at the moment, and it's a 7-year transition period. So at the moment, you're seeing the Common Agricultural Policy flat rate payments going down, so farmers are having less money in their pocket. But the government's introducing their new programs, such as the SFI, the Sustainable Farming Incentive, which is now picking up, so farmers can go and apply for specific payments for specific public goods. And lots of criticisms flying around that it's too slow, that it's too complicated, that farmers don't follow it. But the government, DEFRA in particular, are doing their best. And they're looking at ways in which they can support farmers and enable farmers to get hold of these funds and farm better. And it's not that we're seeking to stop farming or that the government's seeking to stop farming in turn purely to environmentalism. They're just seeking to make our existing farming processes better and more sustainable and environmentally friendly.
Are these national initiatives, or is there a special relationship between Westminster and Devon?
So,
does it look at regions separately?
Yeah, they are national initiatives, and it goes Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland have their own system, so this is an English approach. And it is flat across the country, but it favours or different types of farming get different types of support. And currently there is concern that a lot of the pasture farming, particularly the upland farming, such as you see on Dartmoor and Exmoor in Devon, is not getting the support that you're seeing for the more lowland, intensive arable farming. And that is a current critique of what's been released so far. But not everything has been released, and the processes are being developed as we go along. What I would say with respect to the Southwest and Devon in particular is we have a remarkable amount of academic knowledge in this space. There are probably more climate scientists per square hectare in Devon, world-class climate scientists, than anywhere else on Earth. At Plymouth University, you've got brilliant marine and coastal science. Exeter University, you've got amazing land-based environmental science. And then you've got the Rothamsted Research Institute and a bunch of other really serious environmental science institutions, all based in the Southwest. And what we're looking at, and particularly obviously here at the Southwest Innovation Expo, is how you turn that knowledge into productive, applied uses. And there's a real skill set to that. And it's something that the Southwest, I think, has a real opportunity to not only lead the country, but lead the world in some of these areas.
And I know that up there in Westminster, you are driving the narrative for the Southwest, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm seeking to. I mean, I when I joined the House of Lords back in 2018, I think, I slightly vainly said, oh, I'll represent the interests of Devon in Westminster. And everyone said, no, the MPs represent the interests of their constituents. Obviously, you as a hereditary peer can't do that. But I thought, well, okay, I can champion the interests of Devon in the way that, you know, I'm a feudal lord, right? We've been doing this for 900 years. So you do. I champion the interests of Devon, try and speak on behalf of the county. I'm not political. I'm not a member of a political party. I'm crossbench. And it's really nice to be able to do that. So I look at where Devon's strengths are, and our natural capital is a huge strength for the county, and seek to fight that corner in Westminster, and similarly bring some of Westminster's wisdom down to Devon, which is where I live and work and have my business.
Fantastic. Now, Jake, you're championing innovation, obviously. How Yep. open is the sector to new ideas and receiving that innovation?
Historically, not very at all, mainly because it was all down to the bottom line. Unless it could guarantee to save you money, what would be the purpose of implementing it? because of current change, because of current pressures, what we've found with a lot of the partner farms that we've been working with and the projects that we're doing is there is such a huge demand and such a need from people and want to try something new, to try and integrate these new methods, to see, okay, what is the next system? What is the next method they can use that will actually work? And there's very much just kind of echoing some of the key aspects of Devon versus some the rest of the country. Round here in particular, especially compared to like East Anglia and that kind of area, over there you see automation and the kind of machinery and robotics being implemented, which is very large, which is very huge, which aims to do things at a massive scale, which I would argue the UK isn't quite tailored that way, especially around Devon and the whole southwest region. There's a lot more smaller areas. You've got hills, you've got small fields in those areas, and the key is creating technology that can adapt to that environment. If we can get a system working and running across the hills, valleys, and the very mucky areas around here, we can guarantee it will almost run anywhere quite easily in the rest of the country. And that's from experience, having been out in fields with robots around here and out the west.
You say the rest of the country, but I mean, it's fair to say these are global challenges. These are international, planet Earth challenges. You quite rightly say that, yes, the United Kingdom, we're a small island, so we have to approach things slightly differently. We've got a finite resource available to us. But if we're striving for development here, are there any international opportunities available to us? Can we develop stuff here and then take it abroad? What's the international conversation with regards to agritech?
I find it quite interesting. I spent quite a lot of time in California and in the US where I worked for 10 years. And, they are fascinated at looking at what we are doing from a regulatory legislative perspective, because no other country is really legislated for the environmental land management processes that we have. So we are a bit of a petri dish for the rest of the world. It's like, can this work? And the one thing the UK is very good at is regulating, is auditing, is measuring. We have great accountants.
We're good at paperwork, aren't we? Let's face it, we're good at paperwork.
But in international supply chains, right, the one thing they're concerned to do is to validate the claims that they're making, that their product is net zero and they're able to put the carbon back in the ground that they claim to be doing. And at the moment, it's a bit of a Wild West. There's lots of claims being put out there. There's lots of battles over, is it better to eat meat-based protein or plant-based protein? What's better for the planet? And we have the science and we have the professional services that allow us to really validate those things. And I think that is our export market. The UK is never going to move the needle globally on net zero climate change and biodiversity. We're too small, right? We're a small little island in the North Atlantic. But our regulatory power, our legislative power is quite strong, and our soft power is quite strong. And if we can get it right here, then we can export that around the world, which is what's really exciting. So there is lots of potential, but we have to do the work here to get it right.
Great. Jake, earlier on you touched on AI in farming. What does that look like exactly? And I guess that's probably a... Have you got a crystal ball? Because AI is this very fast-moving target. We are talking about conversations. We're having conversations now that we wouldn't even dream about having last year. But AI in farming, what does that look like?
The important thing with AI is because of the adaptability of it, it can be used in almost any kind of situation. And in terms of how it's best used, it's about tailoring it. So for every farm or every farmer, how they will use it will vary between them. Some might need it more to help manage on the paperwork or the accountant side. Some might instead have that running their machines out in the field. And in terms of the key term AI, it is rather all-encompassing, because it includes a lot of basic programming thing, which, okay, we've got some sensors, we can detect when there's more rainfall or there's chemicals rolling down the hill. Yes, we can feed that into AI and create these really dynamic responses from it, but at the end of the day, not everything needs to be AI. We don't have to overcomplicate. We just need to be able to incorporate some of the simple things that are already out there that haven't been incorporated so far.
Is it just because it's a buzzword at the moment?
I would argue it's a buzzword, but every couple of months, the evolution and how far it evolves is dramatic. So give it a couple of years and it might be controlling all the robots, controlling all the technology out there. But more than likely, it's going to be a tool that we use. The same way that a screwdriver, electric screwdriver, didn't put carpenters out of business, AI is not going to put farmers out of business. Instead, it's going to be a tool that helps them make their land more efficient.
I was going to ask you, actually, bring you into the conversation, because I know that you have, from a legal point of view, and it has here on my notes, AI and IP, IP being intellectual property. Just to go a little bit on a sideline, what are your thoughts there? Because this is a very, very, very grey area.
Yeah, well, just to go back to the AI and farming, of course, most Devon livestock farmers have been using AI for decades because it's artificial insemination. So they're perfectly comfortable with the concept of AI. It's just the IP of it has been stolen by the computer tech firms who now claimed AI to be their invention. But the intellectual property elements of AI are complex. A lot of these AI large language models obviously are trained upon information that they scrape off the internet. A lot of that information belongs to people. It's copyrighted. And so they're training their AI engines off of material that belongs to people without actually getting a license or paying those people any royalties. And so you see a number of these cases going on both in the UK and the US, particularly amongst sort of well-known celebrities, Sarah Silverman being one of them, saying, hang on, you've taken my voice, you've taken my written word, you've taken my performance, and you've trained your machine off of it, and now you're monetizing that machine without paying me any royalties. So this actually is stuff that belongs to people, and the development of AI is effectively grand larceny of intellectual property. And the government have been investigating this. The Intellectual Property Office have been investigating it. They've got the tech developers around the table along with the creative industries to try and see if they can work out a licensing model. Unfortunately, those discussions have not concluded with a positive outcome. They've called off those discussions, and we're currently waiting on the IPO and the government to say, okay, this will be the next step in this battle, because at some point the courts are going to decide this, and they're going to decide that probably a number of these LLMs have been infringing copyright. The issue then becomes, well, which jurisdiction are you infringing? Is it in the US? Is it in the UK? And they'll say, look, it's in whichever jurisdiction doesn't have the strongest copyright laws, which is probably not the UK. So it's a complicated area, and it's one that makes the development of AI and the adoption of AI quite uncertain for businesses.
Well, just something to add to that AI point as well, because ultimately, all these AI models, they are just mathematical models. So some of them, yeah, they have used copyright material. There's a lot of cases with artists and their material that's been used, and debates around that. A lot of these models, they use that material to create a new mathematical model. Those models have already gone past the material used in many cases. So a lot of the new AI models aren't even based on, like, current works and written pieces. So there's a lot of now embedded devices that run these mathematically incredibly efficient models because they found new ways of doing that. And those are some of the things that we're now incorporating into various different kind of robotics, whether it's with the dogs to help the balancing or with some of the drones for mapping the environment. So AI as a whole, my one cautionary is don't write off AI as this terrible, scary thing right from the get-go. There's a lot of potential and power from it. And in many ways, it just makes the programmer's life a lot easier because you don't have to write anywhere near as much code for it.
Yeah, I agree with that very much, actually. You know, yes, there are issues around the licensing and ownership of the original training materials, but I don't think AI is going to supplant humans. And I don't think that AI is actually going to be a replacement for good, proper farming practices. You know, one of the really interesting elements, and probably the area where we have most yet to discover, you can confirm this to me, Jake, is around soil science. It's so blimming complicated how soil works, how organic matter works. And that's the secret to sustainable farming, is looking after the bread and butter, the basic soil in which we grow things. And there is an awful lot of learning to be done. And that's just hardcore scientists going out, testing soil, yes, running it through AI predictive technology to get the data, but you've effectively just got to go and work in the soil. And that's where I think our Devon farmers are really, really good.
Fantastic. Charles, Jake, thank you very much both for joining us here today. And also thank you for listening to our first episode of Innovation Conversations from the Southwest Innovation Expo.
Thank you for listening to Innovation Conversations, recorded by Fresh Air Studios on location at Southwest Innovation Expo, Sandy Park, Exeter, on the 5th of March 2024. This podcast was produced as a joint venture between the University of Exeter and the University of Plymouth. Presented by Paul Philpott. Engineering and video editing by Mark Stevenson. Audio editing by Martin Burgess Moon. Production assistance by Lisa Hartwell. Producers for the University of Exeter, Marina Alto, Georgia Brown, and Andrew Dean. Producers for the University of Plymouth, Rich Adams and Melanie Jones. Copyright University of Exeter and University of Plymouth.